Did you know that the McMaster University has its own climate change center? It has. Just about a year ago, it was formed, put together with 24 scientists and researchers studying the effects of global warming. Mike Waddington is the center's associate director, and he came to speak to Environment Hamilton as they celebrate their 10th year in Hamilton. The aim and the hope of this research group is to bring together university researchers, parliamentary researchers, and other interested parties from the industry. Waddington said the center split $1.5 million over 10 years in funding from the RBC Foundation with water-related projects at McMaster. He said the funding allowed the center to host first of many seminars. It touched on how Canada is being affected by climate change and what the country can do to improve its environmental sustainability. You can look for more seminars the public can attend coming this September.
Peat fires contribute a large source of carbon to the atmosphere, and the negative health impacts from resulting poor air quality are a large concern in many places. So we're pleased to welcome Dr. Waddington tonight, who will tell us more about the McMaster Center for Climate Change and to talk more about the potential impacts of climate change here in Hamilton. Mike.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak here tonight. As mentioned, I'm the associate director of the relatively new McMaster Center for Climate Change. You're celebrating your 10th birthday. We're celebrating our 13th month. We were founded mainly because of the wisdom of a former provost of the university, and it happened in the spring, or I should say the winter, but it felt like the spring, of 2007, when 90% of Canadians had a green Christmas. Essentially challenged us to pull together a lot of the climate change researchers at McMaster. And so last March, we had our inaugural presentation. We had Dr. Gordon McBain from University of Western Ontario, who's a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, give us a talk. And there was many of you were at that presentation. So what I thought I would do tonight is just give an overview of some of the work that's being done at McMaster, and I'm just going to touch on a very small portion of it, and also talk a little bit of my own research, so I can explain what that ecohydrology means, but also talk a little bit about some aspects of what we're doing at McMaster, which certainly touch a home here in Hamilton. I'm from Hamilton, I grew up in Hamilton, I love Hamilton. And so it's good to have an opportunity to talk a little bit about that. Let me introduce you to the Anthropocene. This is not a great era. And the reason for that is there's a lot of bad news. I'm just going to take you through some trends that we're seeing and a little bit of bad news, and I'll finish with some good news. Here we have the trend in methane concentration. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, as many of you know. It's about 25 times more powerful than CO2, and we see this trend of increasing concentration with time. I can switch over and show you carbon dioxide. And this is an old picture because we're now up to a whopping 388 parts per million. And as I saw out there, and I see a button on Jim Quinn right there, we know that 350 is a critical concentration not to exceed, and we're blowing quite past that. You can show another greenhouse gas, which is nitrous oxide, which comes mainly from the use of fertilizers. And we're seeing a huge exponential increase in its concentration. It's 300 times more powerful than CO2. So if we're going to want to increase forest yield or carbon uptake in forests and we're adding fertilizer, that's not a good idea, because our greenhouse warming potential, nitrous oxide, is a bit more bad news. I can show one more. We can look at the loss of ozone. And then even more bad news is the number of natural disasters due to climate. And this is what's getting the attention of a lot of people, in particular the insurance industry. So we just blew through the biggest ever claims in the insurance industry because of these climatic disasters. And finally, as we all know, perhaps the worst bad news of it all is the disturbing trend
about increasing temperature. What we have here is the temperature for 1960 to 1990, going through the last 150 years, and then we can put up here 2010, which was the warmest year ever on record. These are the top 10 years on record, all having occurred in the last 15. Now the good news for 2010 being the warmest year on record is that didn't allow the climate skeptics to say plot a graph from here to here and say that temperature is actually decreasing. And you don't have to go and look around the news very much right now to still see a lot of those people making those claims, and there's a real doozy of one in the Calgary Herald a few days ago. So this is bad news. But why it's bad news is I can expand that to another bunch of different trends. We can include biodiversity, we can look at coastal zone biogeochemistry. Is this unprecedented change is undermining the climate system and ecosystem stability. And we're seeing that globally, we're seeing it regionally, we're certainly seeing it locally. And this is quite disturbing. And now for the good news. That's what happened in the past. The good news is what's happening in the future. That may seem a little strange for me to say it's good news, but I just showed you this last plot, it came to about here. And if we look at the next 100 years and look at the different global circulation models and predictions by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we're expecting a further change from between 2 and up to 6 degrees temperature globally. I'll explain to you a little bit why that's good news, first of all, but if we go to that location there, that's what we're committed to. We're going to have that much warming, even if we were to decrease or stop CO2 and carbon emissions today. Go a little bit warmer, once we go above 2 degrees Celsius, we're going to see a large biodiversity loss. Get to 3 Celsius, we're going to see the loss of the Greenland ice sheet and massive changes in sea level rise. When we get up to this level, we're getting large carbon feedbacks, which are going to have a major push on climate. And then lastly, we get up to 5 degrees and modern civilization collapses. Now, why is this the good news? Well, it's great news because climatologists are telling you that. It's the first time that in the history of the world, thanks to science, we can actually predict our demise. We're the first generation to actually be able to prepare for catastrophic change. We know what's going to happen, whereas in the past, we didn't have the level of science to be able to make those predictions. So massive collapses will occur. So we now have the means to be able to control our own destiny, if you will. Maybe a little bit ironic, I'm not sure the right word is, but the risks are large, and what really is important, the exciting and good news, is the business as usual is not an option. I don't have to say that to this group, they know that. What we need to do is make sure that's very clear to politicians. So it's in that context that the McMaster Center for Climate Change was formed, and here's our mission is to bring in different aspects of education, research, and community outreach. We'll talk a little bit about those different things. And we're going to be looking at the impacts of climate change on the environment, ecosystems, water resources, and human health, bringing together, at the moment, over 24 researchers at McMaster University. One of the goals is to encourage the use of our scientific knowledge to look at aspects of sustainability and resiliency of ecosystems, water resources, and to help develop public policy to mediate that. And this is the graph that I've shown you for a whole range of different aspects. And what we need to do is use research and public outreach and discussions like this today to bend that curve. And we really have to do that in this decade. We have to start this curve to start to be bent, or we will be well on our way to that 5-degree temperature increase. There's a bunch of objectives. I've got a couple of pamphlets out there, so I won't bore you with them, but what we are bringing is a multidisciplinary approach to looking at climate change. Within the School of Geography and Earth Sciences, we have no less than 4 or 5 climatologists. We also have links to members of Environment Canada, but also through departments of biology. We're also in several faculties across the university. Looking at, as I said before, climate change and ecosystems, water resources, human health, and society. Also the human perceptions aspect is, well, 2008, the election was all about climate change. It's not about climate change anymore. Why is that? Promoting education and teaching. We're trying to generate the next generation of climate researchers and also business owners and politicians in our program. And also enhancing public outreach. And next Monday we'll be having, I think, over 150 students from Highland Secondary School coming to McMaster and learning how we do research on climate change. And also we have a presentation in the spring and autumn of each year. So the first week in October, just before your birthday, so it'll be a nice way of starting off the big celebrations. We're bringing in one of the most well-known urban climatologists in Canada, Professor Emeritus at University of British Columbia, will be talking about climate and aspects of air quality. So very important for here in Hamilton. Our research areas include physical climate modeling. So we actually have researchers at McMaster who are contributing to linking climate models to the global circulation models, ecosystems impacts and adaptation, water resources and hydroclimate. I'll show a little slide about this shortly, but we have a researcher who's looking at whether our infrastructure will be able to handle the water flows that we're expecting under climate change. We already know it can't, because Hamilton has a problem there, right? We're looking at paleoclimate to put into context what we're seeing today. Is it unprecedented in the history? Infrastructure impacts, like I've mentioned. And lastly, human health and societal impacts. Oh, and finally, remediation, resiliency, and public policy. Let me just talk a little bit about some of the work that's being done at McMaster. This is from Dr. Pauline Koulibaly, who's in the Department of Civil Engineering and also in the School of Geography and Earth Sciences. And he just published a paper on expected changes in flows in the Spencer Creek watershed, the largest watershed within the city of Hamilton. I was at a town hall meeting, I guess it was about a month ago, and there was some really wonderful things stated there. But being a scientist, I'd like to see hard data. And what this scientist has done is he's taken the global circulation models and downscaled the data, meaning we can find out what the changes are going to be right here in Hamilton. And what he's done is taken what's considered as a conservative climate change scenario, and uses this downscaled GCM, global circulation model data. And what he's done it for is for the 2050s, which is under the IPCC, you're running from 2046 to 2065. And what he's finding is that we're going to have about a 15% increase in mean annual precipitation. Now, that doesn't sound like much. We get about 900 millimeters here in Hamilton a year, so we're going to be going a little bit over 1,000. But what's important about that is the distribution of that precipitation is going to become a lot more extreme. We're going to go through periods of large drought and then very large rainfall events. So we're going to get a lot more of what we've seen in the last couple of years. A 2 to 3 Celsius increase in the mean minimum and maximum temperatures. That's a very big increase. In fact, that'll double our number of extreme heat days. And we had a speaker from Health Canada talking about extreme heat just 2 weeks ago at the Innovation Park. We're in the city of Waterfalls, and I love photography, so I had to show this one. This was last March, about the same time as our Climate Change Center was formed. That's Tiffany Falls, and I called it Tiffany's Anger, a 50-year flood event that occurred in the Hamilton area. And why this is important is the work by Dr. Koulibaly is showing that we're going to see a small decline in snow storage, mainly because of higher melt, but we will see greater snowfall. Increases in evapotranspiration, so we're going to see increases in drought. But the important one is a 10 to 25% increase in stream flows, highest in winter and autumn. So these large events that we have seen increasing over the last few years are going to increase even more. That means more flooding of the Red Hill Expressway. That means more flooding of people's basements. At the same time, we're going to see a decrease. Their research is showing a decrease in groundwater recharge, especially in the summer, meaning that some of the low flows are going to be very low and the high flows are going to be very high, which is showing this extreme changes in precipitation that we're expecting. So that, That's not good news for us here in Hamilton. What's really important is well, how could we get it so wrong? I mean, we've just created this very expensive highway. It's flooding all the time. We're getting all these large flows. And a lot of the reason is that scientists and particularly engineers like to think of things as being very linear. And we know that things are very nonlinear in an environment, that we have these threshold changes where you can have a very dramatic change in the system. And that might be because we've just whacked the system too hard. We've had too much land use change. We've had too much hot CO2 in the atmosphere. And we can get very different responses in the future. Some of the work that I do is in the north is on permafrost, and the threshold there is the freezing point. Of course, we're doing a lot of work in Alaska and Northwest Territories, and also the aspects of wildfire. I'll just give an example of some of the work that I'm doing in the north is. We have a threshold change depending on how much organic matter is on the landscape. So here we have two different fires, a very high severity fire where it burns through all of the organic matter. And as a result, you're going to get a hardwood forest now, which used to be black spruce. You get a low severity fire with a little bit more organic matter, you're still going to have conifers on that landscape. So a very dramatic change can occur depending on the threshold. We see this in ecosystems, especially in the arid regions, and there's a really wonderful book I suggest you read is by Jared Diamond. There's a couple people nodding, so I'm sure people have read it, which talks about society collapses, which sort of comes back to my good news aspect, is that we know that this is happening and is going to happen with respect to climate change. And I it was really cool to hear the word resilience. Communities used a fair bit. I mean, as a person who does work in hydrology linked with ecology, I'm very interested in how moisture drives ecosystems. So a change in moisture can cause a very dramatic change in an ecosystem. And what I have just shown here is a little cartoon just showing how we might have these different stable states in the environment. It could be stream flow, it could be biodiversity. As we lose ecosystem services, we could end up with a dramatic shift, and that was similar to that that figure I showed on the previous slide. And I'll just say that from a Hamilton perspective, I would argue that from a hydrological perspective, is our hydrological resiliency, if you will, is in dramatic decline. What should the city of Hamilton do to mitigate that? Well, certainly, and I don't need to preach to the choir here, is you certainly wouldn't be wanting to expand the urban boundary, in that we have ecosystems in this region which are providing very valuable ecosystem services. We continue to change that in combination with unprecedented climate change. We are only going to cause dramatic issues. And I'll just show some examples that we're doing. Here we have the watershed, the Spencer Creek watershed, and we are very lucky in that we do have a lot of green space. They have a conservation authority which has invested heavily and was very ahead of the curve, if you will, land acquisitions. Why I'm back in Hamilton, I don't think you can find a city in southern Ontario with a university town that has as much green space. So certainly protecting our watershed ecosystem services is a good way of enhancing our resilience to climate change, conserving our natural areas, and also enhancing watershed resilience, and I'll talk a little bit about that shortly, and building our urban resilience, building back our ecosystems and reclaiming them. And as a researcher, I think it's really important that we quantify these efforts, so the ones I've shown above. It's really important to be able to go to a council, to a government, and so on, with hard data. And saying, if we don't do this, this is the consequence. If we do this, this is the benefit. And so we can use that research to inform policy. And we're currently doing that in my research with respect to wildfire. I'll end on that note shortly. I've been very fortunate when I came back to McMaster to have known and to interact with Bruce, the late Bruce Duncan. And he was really excited about getting research in the Hamilton Conservation Authority by McMaster. We've done a lot of work up in the headwaters of the Spencer Creek and the Beverly Swamp. And I'm very very proud of the Conservation Authority and their ability to protect our ecosystem services through the amount of the watershed that they protect. We've got a lot of important forests, wetlands, and riparian zones, which still need to be protected and enhanced to enhance that resiliency. When I first started working in the Beverly Swamp, well, let's go back to this picture here. For those that don't know, the Fletcher Creek flows from the upper portion of the Galt Moraine in Puslinch, and then that joins into Spencer, and Spencer actually flows out of the Valens Reservoir. And when I was doing my work, I realized that the Spencer Creek actually runs dry in the middle of the summertime. And what's important is that it has a big impact on the water chemistry of the downstream area, and that you get these big pulses of sulfate, and that's really bad because it can cause a very dramatic acid shock, which can have an impact on fisheries, on the fish in the stream. And so what we have is we have a wetland which is meant to store water downstream from a dam which is meant to store water. You put the two together and you can actually have that system go dry in the summer. So it's really important that we not only conserve these ecosystems, but we think a little bit better about how they can be conserved. The director of the Climate Change Center is Dr. Rain, and he does a lot of work on reforestation, although not in Hamilton. One way of being able to enhance watershed resilience of the region is of course through tree planting. And what they're trying to do within the Climate Change Center is to quantify the amount of carbon which is stored by white pine plantations. It's actually part of a very large network of researchers in Canada that are looking at a whole range of ecosystems across the country. And his work is taking place at Turkey Point. So about an hour and a half from the area. And what they're doing is looking at pine forests of different ages and going from an 8-year-old up to a 70-year-old forest. And they have some very fancy equipment to do this, but just to cut to the chase, what this is just showing is the amount of carbon uptake based on versus the age of the forest. And what's really incredible is the carbon uptake. It peaks about 3 decades before we see a natural forest. So you can get a tremendous amount of carbon taken up by the vegetation and therefore reducing amount in the atmosphere very quickly, which is what his work has shown. In my work, I've been trying to build urban resilience, if you will, and trying to come up with ways of being able to restore degraded areas. In particular, this is a quarry in the Puslinch area. I do a lot of work in parts of Quebec and Alberta as well, but trying to take degraded ecosystems and to rebuild them. So what we're looking at is essentially trying to grow plants on rock in areas which have been were previously quarries, and sort of just leaving them as flooded portions of the landscape, trying to create a useful watershed again. And these are much cheaper and more valuable ways in very large engineering projects. So the city of Hamilton, of course, spent a tremendous amount of money for these holding tanks, which we've realized only can really hold one large storm at a time. So you get two of these large storms back to back, we're pumping a lot of crap into the Hamilton Harbor. So we really do need to rethink about the resilience of the entire system and can grow a better watershed perspective. I was going to leave just very, very quickly, just mention some work that's being done on air pollution. And what we have is a big issue coming to Hamilton. We're increasing our temperature by 2050 by 2 to 3 degrees. We're going to increase the number of smog days. And some of the work that the Climate Change Center is involved in is coming up with better ways of predicting health exposure of various pollutants. Here we have NO2, which are predictions from Dr. Rain's work, which is looking at health exposures by linking it to land use regression and wind field models. So some work that we're doing as well for the city of Hamilton. I'm going to finish off a little bit on some of the work that I'm doing and air pollution, climate change, and ecosystems. And I guess that when you look at this is the summer of 2010 in Russia. What does it have to do with ecosystems? Well, as some of you may know, we had what's being considered rogue weather. Not climate change, but we'll call it rogue weather. The same system which resulted in 3,000 millimeters of rain landing on Pakistan resulted in very large drought in Russia. And what it was we ended up with two times the normal deaths due to poor air quality due to wildfire. And it was actually the burning of peat fires, which is the ecosystem that I do a lot of research in. And the reason for that is they went through massive land use change in around Moscow to increase agriculture, but also to increase the productivity of the forests. So these were very poor forests. They're in very wet environments, and they drained this ecosystem to make the trees grow better. Well, once it got very dry, they caught on fire, and they wouldn't stop. They just keep smoldering and smoldering. So the work that we're doing with the Canadian Forest Service is to come up with a better way of being able to predict when these peat fires will occur. It's not just in the northern ecosystems, but the largest ever increase in CO2 concentration in the world was a result to what we'll call a triple whammy of land use change, climate change, and El Nino in Indonesia. Very bad air pollution in Singapore, and it resulted from palm oil draining of very large ecosystems for palm oil and also for the mega rice project under Suharto. And so 1997-98, the amount of emissions from these fires in this region alone was equal to almost 40% of the annual fossil fuel emissions. So what this is illustrating, and I'm trying to maybe not necessarily something we're going to see here in Hamilton, but bring it home about land use change coupled to climate change is a really bad situation. So what we're doing in our work in the boreal forest, and my gang will be on their way out in a day or two to the sites in Alberta, is looking at trying to predict ways of being able to predict fire, but also to reduce the risk of fire by increasing the resilience of these ecosystems. So instead of planting trees, we're trying to figure out ways of reducing fire risk. And I won't bore you too much with this, but it's kind of exciting in a way. What we have here are two different types of moss, little plants. The green one grows in one half of the landscape, and the yellow one grows in the other half. And everything under those lines is what might burn 50 years after a fire and 100 years after the fire. So only this moss species burns a little bit of that one after about 100 years of a fire. But land use change or climate change all of a sudden makes the trees in the landscape a lot bigger, which means a lot more fuel available to burn. And what we're finding now under climate change is a larger portion of the landscape is available to burn. Larger portion of landscape means more CO to the atmosphere, means more particulate. We know all about that here in Hamilton, in the poorer air quality. So we're trying to do some neat things with the Canadian Forest Service on that. It's just another example of the work that we're doing at McMaster. Now, it's not all doom and gloom. Very luckily, at the last second at the COP16 meeting in Mexico, the different countries agreed in the future maybe we will allow countries to get credits for their carbon emissions by restoring ecosystems. And I think this is a really good opportunity for Canada to actually right some wrongs. So a bit of an encouragement there. And why that's exciting for the work that I do is that we take ecosystems like this, which were drained for sphagnum peat moss. And I'm sure there's a bunch of you out there who probably use peat moss in their gardens to try to get a nicer growing garden, but that's what it ends up looking like if they don't do restoration. And after a couple of years, we can convert that ecosystem back into a healthy carbon storing system again. So I think this is another example of how we can use technology that we know, green technology, to enhance resiliency and also carbon storage on the landscape. And I'll just finish off with this.